Our gospel reading for today comes from Luke 19, 28 through 40. After telling this story, Jesus went on toward Jerusalem, walking ahead of his disciples. As he came to the town of Bethpage and Bethany on the Mount of Olives, he sent two disciples ahead. "Go into that village over there," he told them. "As you enter it, you will see a young donkey tied there that no one has ever ridden. Untie it and bring it here. If anyone asks, 'Why are you untying that colt?' just say, 'The Lord needs it.'" So they went and found the colt just as Jesus had said. And sure enough, as they were untying it, the owner asked them, "Why are you untying that colt?" And the disciples simply replied, "The Lord needs it." So they brought the colt to Jesus and threw their garments over it for him to ride on. As he rode along, the crowd spread out their garments on the road ahead of him. When he reached the place where the road started down to the Mount of Olives, all his followers began to shout and sing as they walked along, praising God for all the wonderful miracles they had seen. "Blessings on the King who comes in the name of the Lord. Peace in heaven and glory in highest heaven." But some of the Pharisees among the crowd said, "Teacher, rebuke your followers for saying that." He replied, "If they kept quiet, the stones along the road would burst into cheers." This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God.
Jesus, I thank you for this space. It is holy and sacred to me, but I believe it to be holy and sacred to you. And so I just ask that you would come and be with us in this moment and in this time. I just pray that you would be near, that you would be gentle, and that you would do what I feel like I ask you every week, that you would give us the courage to look inside ourselves at something you may want to expose or redo or refine or start or finish. We love you and we thank you. In your name we pray. Amen. So happy Palm Sunday. We've spent our Lenten season together this year in a series called Deeper, based on a book called Emotionally Healthy Spirituality. And I keep saying this because it's true. It's not just based on a book called Emotionally Healthy Spirituality. It is just stolen from a book called Emotionally Healthy Spirituality. But we've spent the last 30 days-ish together taking a pretty intense inward journey into our own hearts and our own minds and our own emotions, our own losses. And today we'll be no different on the intensity of this inward journey. But we've done this with the premise, or under the premise, that of this idea that our spiritual lives will not ever outpace our emotional lives. So for our final week of Emotionally Healthy Spirituality, my hope is that we'll take this inward journey that we've been on and do with it what I think all spiritually formative journeys do, which is to take us outward into our relationships with other people. I think the inward is always supposed to lead us back out into the world. So this journey, it has been all about practicing the presence of Jesus inwardly in us. But part of the reason that we do that is to allow it to teach and inform how we practice the presence of people outwardly in the world. Because there is an emotional and spiritual health to be talked about and discovered in our relationship with other people. And so to start it out, I want to tell the story about a wealthy woman. The story takes place in the novel, The Brothers Karamazov by Dostoevsky. And in the story, this elderly woman comes to a monk and asks him how she can know that God is real. She says, how can I know that God is real? And the monk answers her, and he says, there's really no way to explain or argue for the existence of God. His thought is that the only way that we can know that God is real is by the practice of what he calls actual love, active love. That we can't really fully explain and argue the existence of God. The only way that we can know God is real is by this practice of actual and active love. And it's a beautiful answer. And so the woman, she responds to him, and I think really honestly, she says, I dream of loving like that. I dream of living a life with this practice of an active love, this practice of the presence of people and loving people. But she says, I'm afraid if I were to actually do what I dream about, if I were to actually love that way, then I would have to become a nun and give up everything I have and become really poor. And then she says this, she says, and I'm afraid that if I did that, like if I gave up all of my stuff, I became poor, I became a nun, then my job would be to serve the people that I most dream about loving. But I'm afraid that if I did that and if I serve them, they still might be ungrateful and whiny. And they might complain about how I don't make very good soup or I don't make a bed very well. Which highlights in her biggest fear that if she were to give up so much, that people would still be ungrateful. And she says, I'm just afraid I wouldn't be able to bear that. And the monk responds even wiser, I think, this time. And he says this. He says, love in practice is a harsh and dreadful thing compared to love in dreams. Welcome to church. Love in practice is a harsh and dreadful thing compared to love in dreams. It's true though, right? In my life, especially in adulthood, I imagine that friendship would look this certain way. But the active practice of love that sustains long-term friendships is different than I imagined it would be. The love that I imagined and dreamed would sustain a marriage has been very different than the love that my marriage has required. The imagination I had for what parenting would be like has been very different than the love that it actually takes to show up day after day in the lives of my kids. This has been really true for me, that love in practice is often a harsh and dreadful thing compared to the love of my dreams. And I think all of this takes place in reality, which we've talked every single week over the last few weeks about being fiercely committed to being in reality, to love in practice in reality. And I think that to do that, this is what life in Christ requires. He's asking us to live in reality and to love in reality. C.S. Lewis says it like this, though. He says, to love at all is to be vulnerable. Love anything and your heart will be wrung and possibly broken. Love, it takes work. The work of conversations and repair and forgiveness and vulnerability and humility and relentless hope, true and deep and real love between us and God and us and others. As we learn to practice the presence of people in active love, it requires not just a hopeful vision of the world, but a realistic vision of the world as well. The world as it is, a kingdom vision that lives both in the world as it could be and hope for the world as it could be, but also in the world as it actually is. Active love is a lot of work. And it is over a long period of time. But as apprentices to Jesus, I think it is our work. So my hope today is to talk really practically about an active way of love in our relationships. But before I jump to the really practical stuff, I want to talk a little bit more about why. When I was in high school, I was going to volunteer at a camp for a month in the summer. And in order to do that, we went through this training. And part of the training was that we had to memorize the first part of Philippians 2. It's like 16 verses or something of Philippians 2. And it was really, really hard. But I had to do it because I wanted to volunteer at the camp and my dad was the trainer. So he'd be checking in like, you know, did you memorize? And it's like, oh, yeah, yeah. And then I think I crammed the night before as typical me. But the reality is I memorized a lot of these verses. And 25 years later, these verses still live in me, which I'm very, very grateful for. And so I just want to read them to you. This is their first two verses from Philippians 2. And it says this: is there any encouragement from belonging to Christ? Any comfort from his love? Any fellowship together in the Spirit? Are your hearts tender and compassionate? So what Paul's saying there is like, have there been any benefits to following Jesus? Have you experienced anything of the love of Christ? And then he says this in verse 2. Then make me truly happy by agreeing wholeheartedly with each other, loving one another, and working together with one mind and one purpose. Why does active love matter if it can be dreadful at times? It matters because part of following the way of Jesus means that what we experience with him will lead us into the lives of other people. And it is meant to lead us into loving one another, agreeing with one another, working with each other in purpose and in mind. Emotionally Healthy Spirituality, the book, talks about this in the lens of one of the Ten Commandments. So God gives Moses the Ten Commandments. Moses brings them to the people of God, these 10 ideas that God had about what flourishing would look like for his people. And the ninth commandment in Exodus 20 says this: you shall not give false testimony against your neighbor. You shall not bear false witness against your neighbor. And I've always read that in kind of like a legal sense, that you can't lie about your neighbor when you're on the stand, or you don't get to slander other people or lie about other people. And I do think that's what God is saying. I absolutely think that that is part of what this commandment is about, is that slander is off the table for God's people, for the flourishing of everyone. But what Jesus does in the New Testament, and especially in the Sermon on the Mount, is he takes the commandments of God and he kind of deepens them. He said, you've always seen him like this, but have you thought about him in this way? Or have you looked at him from this direction? And I think when we do that with this ninth commandment, we see what Jesus is usually trying to train us to do is to see the heart of the law, the heart of God in the law, to see not just the outward manifestation, but the kind of inward change, or the inward challenge, or the inward conversation from God. And if I do this with this ninth commandment, if I look below the surface at the heart of God's order, God's flourishing for people, then it means that I don't think it's just about bearing false witness about people in public. I think it also has something to say about the stories about other people that I tell in my own brain, in my own heart, in my own life. I think bearing false witness also has to do with the assumptions and the false witness that I make against other people, not just in the courtroom, but in my own mind and in my own head and in my own life. And I think that active love dares us to check out our own stories and assumptions about others to see if they are actually true. For example, I've used this story to illustrate this before, but it's a good one. Huck, my son, my youngest son, if you know him, then you know, like, no one on earth wears more jackets than Huck, but still somehow never has a jacket on. It's really kind of impressive how much outerwear he can put on in a given day, and yet every time we get in the car, he has no outerwear, no matter how cold. So it's just, it's a lot of jackets that are part of his life. And so when he was little and he would clean his room, he would clean up his whole room, and then there would always be this like pile of jackets just left on the ground. And a few times he would, like, a couple of them might make it to a hanger, but it was like the saddest excuse for a hanging jacket you've ever seen, you know, just like barely hanging on by a button or something, you know, just like in this weird thing. And it drove me crazy. Like, his whole room would be clean, but then this pile of jackets would just be sitting on the floor. And every time I'd be like, what's with the jackets? Like, hang them up. And so I started to tell myself the story that Huck was just too lazy to hang up his jackets, and he was disobedient because he's not hanging up his jackets. But mainly he's like, he's going to clean his room, but he's too lazy to finish cleaning up his room. And so one day I go in, same thing happens. He's cleaning his room, pile of jackets on the ground, and I just lose it. And I'm like, are you kidding me? I'm like, you have no privileges until every single one of these jackets is hung up. Like, there's no screens, there's no nothing. You do not leave your room until every single jacket is picked up. And so I just leave him in his room for a little while, and I go out, and I come back to check. And when I come back to check, I find Huck in his closet, and he is standing on this dresser thing. And dresser is generous. It's like one of those Rubbermaid, like, drawer things, not meant to hold a human body. And he's standing on the top of the dresser, and he has one hand hanging from the, like, hanging rack, and the other hand is, like, flopping a jacket over a coat hanger. It is like stitches waiting to happen, which, to be fair, is the Mizell's favorite place to be. especially this Mizell. And so he's like hanging on this thing, trying to get this jacket onto this hanger. And that is the first time I realized that the reason Huck wasn't hanging up his jackets wasn't because he was too lazy to, it was because he wasn't tall enough to do it. It's because he like lacked the actual skills to do the thing that I was asking him to do and do it safely. We all have stories like this. In most likely every single relationship and probably every interaction of substance you have with another human being, we create stories and assumptions based on our expectations. And I think more often than we realize, these stories and assumptions go unchecked and they start to bear false witness in our minds. I see this a lot. We do this with groups of people a lot. Like, all two-year-olds are terrible. Or millennials, they're all lazy and entitled. Or all Republicans are, or all Democrats are. And we make these assumptions and stereotype and we tell stories and we bear false witness to individual people based on entire groups because of the stories we've heard or the stories we believed, or because of expectations that were met when we met someone else like them, or expectations that went unmet when we met someone else like them. But it isn't just on a group level. We do this on a personal level as well. In my case, probably much more problematically. Like, here's an example. How many times have you said or heard someone say, that person doesn't like me? And you're like, why don't they like you? And the next thing they say is like, well, they look at me weird. Or like, they talk to other people nicer and different than me. And you're like, do you think maybe they were just like having a bad day or a bad morning? And then the answer is always no. I don't, you know, their mornings are always great. And then they look at me weird and they don't like me. You know, like we all do this stuff. We do it with people we don't know. We do it probably most often with people we do know. You know, if my boss cared about their employees, then they would stop doing this. Or if my husband actually loved me, then he would know that I always need help with this thing. Or if my friends really wanted to be my friends, then they would have whatever. And in these situations, our emotions tend to follow our expectations, and we end up telling a story that feels very, very true, but isn't always true. Like Huck, I had an expectation for him to do something, and when he didn't, I wrote a story that felt very, very true, but was not, in fact, a true story. So, here is the biggest problem with our expectations according to emotionally healthy spirituality. In our lives, most of our expectations fall into the following categories. And we're just going to talk briefly about each of these. They are unconscious, unrealistic, unspoken, and unagreed upon. Unconscious, unrealistic, unspoken, and unagreed upon. So unconscious, we create stories and assumptions in our minds about people based on our disappointment, when in reality we had expectations of them that we didn't even know we had until we were disappointed. Have you ever been here? Have you ever been so frustrated and so disappointed in someone you're not even maybe sure why? This happens to me in friendship all the time, and I think social media has made it 10 times worse. I see a picture of my friends doing something or hear of them doing something that I wasn't a part of, and I immediately get hurt or sad or disappointed. I assume they left me out on purpose. They may be doing something that I absolutely hate. Like maybe they created a running club and they know that my least favorite thing on the whole planet is to actually run. I'll cheer you on, but I ain't running. And like they create a running club and I'm like, they didn't invite me to be in their running club. You know, and it was probably because they don't like me because they looked at me weird too. You know, like we do this thing. We don't even know. I didn't even know I had an expectation that my friends invite me to every single thing they ever do in all of time until they don't invite me. And I'm like, why didn't you, you know, why didn't you know? And I laugh about it, but it's kind of true because these unconscious expectations, they get revealed in a moment where we realize that we had this hope, we had this expectation that we didn't even know we had until it didn't happen the way that we hoped that it would. The second is unrealistic expectations. I think we're all guilty of having expectations for people that they cannot meet for a variety of reasons. This is Huck and the jackets. We have expectations for people's abilities. We have, this is the biggest one for me. I have expectations for people's ability to like critically think and problem solve quicker than a human is really able to do. We have expectations about the availability of people, their time availability, their emotional availability. And we have these expectations, or these expectations for them that they do not have the ability or skills or tools to ever meet. I think we do this a lot with kids, but in addition to kids, I also see this often in me and with people in power. I have expectations for people in power to be absolutely superhuman sometimes. We want our bosses to be perfect and never in a bad mood. We want our community officials to be perfect. I see it a lot in teachers and administrators. We want them to do things exactly as we would have them done. We expect things for them that we would never really even expect for our own selves. Okay, the third kind is unspoken. This is a big one. We have expectations around things that we never actually say out loud. Things we haven't told our friends or our spouses or our partners, our pastors, our coworkers, our family. And we find ourselves angry, hurt, and disappointed when they go unmet, even though we never said them. I want to give you a personal and very embarrassing example of this. Last week was the prom. So Campbell and Graham are going to the prom, and we are meeting some friends for pictures at 5 o'clock at Maryville College. And at 4:15, I am putting together the flowers for the dates, and because I have procrastinated to that point, and I realize I have two things that I don't have. And so I am headed out the door to Target at 4:15, wisdom. And Daniel's pulling in. He sets up the stage for church every Saturday. He's just set up the stage for church. He's pulling in the driveway. And I get out of the car, and I'm like, I'm heading to Target. You take care of things in there. Campbell and Graham are showering, getting ready. I go to Target. I come back at 4:50, which is already a problem because, again, we have to be at Maryville College at 5 o'clock, and we need to leave before 4:50, and I still have to do the flowers. And I walk in, and I realize, like, I see the ties hanging, and they're not tied. Like, ties are not tied. Campbell has no idea where his belt is. I don't even know where Graham is. And I'm yelling for Daniel. I have no idea where he is. And then I hear it before I see it. And that man is mowing the lawn. Okay? It is 4:50 and he is mowing the lawn. And I walk outside and every ounce of anxiety that I'm late, I procrastinated, all this stuff has happened, every bit of anxiety comes out and just explodes onto him. And I'm like, what are you doing with the lawn? You know, and he's kind of smiling at me like, I'm mowing the lawn, you know, it's Saturday. I'm not like, you're welcome, you know, and I'm like, I cannot handle it. Like, stop it right now. And he's like, do you mean to put the mower up? I'm like, I do not. Like, we're getting inside the ties, blah, 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 blah. I mean, I'm just like, are you kidding me? And what's happening in this room is every woman understands and every man is like, he was mowing the lawn. You can't thank a guy. But here is the thing. My expectation when I left to go on my procrastination journey was that Daniel would help everyone get ready and that everything would be perfect and ready to go when I came home. And guess who I told that to? Not a single person. Nobody. I didn't tell Daniel. I told no people. Zero people. And I can, you know, feel inside me that he should know better than mowing the lawn at 4:50. But the truth is, I never shared that with him. And unspoken expectations are not kind to anyone, ever. And I think a lot of us carry around a lot of disappointment in our relationships based on expectations that we never even told somebody we had for them. Okay, last one. Unagreed upon. I'll be quick on this one. Just because we have an opinion about what should happen, and maybe have even said that opinion out loud, does not mean that it was automatically agreed upon by the other person or people. People, especially adult people, they get a say in their stories, and they get to agree with what we expect of them. I can expect Daniel not to mow the lawn 10 minutes before prom pictures, but he is a grown man who gets to agree with that or not. You know? Okay. So those are the four. We have unconscious, unrealistic, unspoken, and unagreed upon. And so if these are the problems, if these are impeding our ability to relate well and love well with others, then what's the flip side? What kind of expectations do we have that will help us become of one mind? How do we work through our expectations of others in a way that is like active love rather than whatever this is? So each of these have an opposite approach. So instead of unconscious expectations, we make our expectations conscious. We make them realistic, spoken, and agreed upon. Conscious. In order for us to form a story or a feeling around an expectation of somebody, we have to be aware that we actually have that expectation. And it is not fair for us to backdate an expectation just because we didn't realize it was there and then hold it true now. Realistic. We keep saying this week after week, a commitment to reality, to how things are and what is actually possible, not just a hope of what we hope is possible. Hope is good, but hope is hope. Hope and expectation, they can't be the same thing. Expectations have to be built on what your boss or employee or coworker or child or student or friend can actually and realistically do. Expectations have to be based in reality. Number three, spoken. Speaking your expectations to someone else is kind. It is honoring and respectful in our relationships with other people to speak what we expect as clearly as we can. And I want to say this as clearly as I can because I love you and I'm saying it to me too and I love me. Your spouse, your friend, your family, your partner, your coworkers, they cannot read your mind. None of them can. And having that expectation isn't kind at all. It does not honor anybody when we expect them to be mind readers and know what we want or expect. That one's for me. Okay, finally, the fourth switch is agreed upon. As I said earlier, for an expectation to be valid, particularly with an adult, they need to be aware of the expectation and agree to it. If an expectation is not agreed upon, it's a hope. And again, hopes aren't bad, but hopes are not expectations. And one more thing on this idea. It also means, this agreed upon, it also means having the grace and mercy and humility to allow room for someone to change their mind. I agree to all sorts of things and get into it and realize like, oh, I actually cannot do this. I think that I have an unlimited amount of time. See previous story on the flowers and the target, right? I believe that I can accomplish so many things. And I love the kind of people in my life who have the grace to let me come back and be like, I can't do that. Like I agreed to that and I can't do it. It's the equivalent of like, mom, I'm too short to hang up the jackets. Like it's okay to say that. It's okay to agree to something and come back around and revisit. Okay, last thing, and then we're gonna close up. What happens when it's God that is not meeting our expectations? We've talked a lot about relationships with other people, but what happens when God or if God doesn't meet our expectations? My most honest answer, if that's your question, is this. He won't. He's not going to. The thing I can guarantee is that he will not meet your expectations 100% of the time. And I have a lot of Bible for this, including our scripture today, which you might be wondering if we were ever going to get to. Here we are. Today is Palm Sunday, and I don't think there's a better passage to talk about expectations in all of the New Testament than this one. Sometimes the heading on this passage, if you're reading it in your paper Bible, the heading on this passage is called the Triumphal Entry. And I think that is just like a hilarious title because that title alone is like this big, hilarious basket of unmet expectations. Because this entry is anything but triumphant in all human terms. Jesus and his disciples, they're in town to celebrate the Passover, and he comes upon what is essentially a parade of welcome for him. And so he tells his disciples, he's like, go into town and get me a donkey to ride on and bring it back. And they've got to be like, what? Like, if go riding a donkey sounds weird to you in 2025, same. Like, what in the world? And they see people are like laying down their coats and they're waving palm branches and they're preparing for this entry of Jesus. And they're doing this as an outward expression of an inward expectation that they have of who Jesus is and who Jesus would be. The palms have a lot of historical context. The palms in the celebration, a lot of historical context. They come from a Jewish practice that came from celebrating strong men overthrowing oppressive regimes in order to set the people of Israel free. There was a very similar parade years earlier for a man named Judas Maccabeus, whose nickname was the Hammer, which if you would like to call me a nickname, I am now going by the Hammer. And the Hammer overthrew this power for the good of the people of Israel. And so the way they celebrated him is they laid down their clothes and they waved palm branches. And so that's like the celebration has context. And so they're expecting that Jesus will come in and that he will be like the Hammer. And so Jesus, he rides into this similar celebration, palms waving, clothes laid down. It was the people's way of saying, we see you and we expect you to rise in power and overthrow the Roman government and rescue us from our current state. But the Hammer didn't ride in that day. Jesus did. Judas Maccabeus, he rode into town on a war horse, but Jesus rides in on a donkey, a king on a donkey, not even a full-grown donkey, a young donkey. Another version of this same story tells us that it was a colt still nursing from its mother. It is the weakest kind of donkey. He picked the weakest horse-like animal and then found its weakest version, and that's how he rode into town. Can you imagine the disappointment and the confusion? God, he will not meet all of our expectations. The Jews in Jesus' town expected a king on a stallion. They expected the Hammer, and what they got instead was Jesus, the Prince of Peace, who would be their rescue, who would set them free in none of the ways that they imagined or expected. My life is filled with the expectations of who and what God will be in me and in others and in the world and in our church. And yet what I get every single time is Jesus, who rides into town on a donkey. And I love Jesus. But sometimes I get really mad that he isn't what I asked for. Honestly, one of the most difficult and important things that I have ever learned in my own life with God is that I have expectations for God that he never, ever, ever agreed to. That he never agreed to. I cannot tell you how many things I am currently holding against God that he didn't do or didn't fix or didn't change or didn't remove, none of which did he agree to. And so if you've ever struggled with not getting something that you wanted very badly or with getting something that you really did not want very badly, if you've ever had a persistent longing for healing or a baby, a change in life situation or a change in relationship, if you in your life have a loss that still makes no sense and maybe even feels punitive, then you know what I'm talking about. And if this is you, then hear the good news today. Jesus came into town riding on a donkey, a symbol not of war, but of peace and hope and love, with the invitation that he would not conform himself to the expectations of this world, but that he would be the way that we could learn to transform our own lives and our own stories and our own expectations toward him. Love requires that Jesus will not be anything other than who he is, the king who rides a donkey, forever the God of rescue, but most always in unexpected ways. So I want to take a couple of minutes here. We have a practice here at Springbrook we call Selah, and it's something we do every Sunday. It's just like a quiet breath to not move on too quickly, and just a chance for you in your own prayer, in your own heart, in your own life to sit for a moment. And so I want to do that. We'll have some verses on the screen that may be helpful, but I have two questions for you to consider. Maybe just pick one of them. But the first one is this. Where am I actively holding like an unmet expectation against someone I'm in a relationship with that they like don't even know about, or I've never said out loud, or they didn't agree to? Where is it that I'm holding offense or bearing false witness against someone I love or maybe don't even really like that they don't know about? And then the second one is this. What am I holding against God that he never agreed to? Okay, I'm going to pray. We'll take a few minutes. So Jesus, we come to you with two hard questions. And we ask for you to feel near as we dare to ask them. Would you show us places that we never imagined we were bearing false witness, but we really are? And then would you give us the courage to dare to see places that we are holding things against you that you did not agree to? Would you meet us with the same mercy and grace and hope that we know you to have and we know you to be? In your name we pray. Amen.